content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine. Today, we're reading from the December 16th, 2022 issue of The Week. The cover drawing this week is a city street scene. We see a police officer standing with his back to us. He's looking down at a park bench or a street bench. A homeless man is asleep on the bench. He's using an American flag for a blanket. His shopping cart full of his goods are to the side of the bench. The headline is, "A Moral Dilemma: What Should Cities Do About Mentally Ill Homeless People?" And I believe that's our controversy of the week. But we will start with the first main story. Warnock's win lifts Democrats. What happened? Georgia Senator Raphael Warnock beat Republican challenger Herschel Walker in a tight runoff election this week, giving Democrats a 51-seat Senate majority and compounding GOP frustration over a midterm performance that fell short of expectations. With nearly all votes counted, Warnock had 51.3% and Walker 48.6%, marking the first time since 1934 that the party in power kept every incumbent Senate seat. The runoff, necessitated by the failure of either candidate to win a majority in November's general election, helped make the Warnock-Walker race one of the most expensive in history, with more than $450 million spent. After a hard-fought campaign, or should I say campaigns, it is my honor to utter the four most powerful words ever spoken in a democracy. "The people have spoken," Warnock said. Walker, a former football star whose candidacy was promoted by Donald Trump, struggled throughout the campaign. He showed a limited grasp of issues, made false claims about his academic and career achievements, and faced a series of damaging personal revelations. They included his ex-wife's claim that he'd abused her and held a gun to her head, two former girlfriends' assertions that the anti-abortion candidate had paid to terminate two pregnancies, and revelations that he'd fathered several previously unacknowledged children. He became the latest of numerous Trump-backed candidates who lost midterm races for Senate and governor seats, thought to be within GOP reach. "The only way to explain this is candidate quality," said Georgia Lieutenant Governor Jeff Duncan. "Every Republican in this country ought to hold Donald Trump accountable." What the columnist said. Warnock's victory could have far-reaching consequences legislatively and politically for Democrats, said Juma Tsai in NPR.org. "It means they have full control of the Senate and its committees instead of the power-sharing arrangement they had under a 50-50 chamber. It will also remove the veto power of cantankerous centrist Senator Joe Manchin or any other single senator, and enables Democrats to more quickly pass legislation and confirm judges and executive branch nominees." Warnock's victory cements Georgia as a competitive battleground state, said Patricia Murphy in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. It was a surprise when Warnock and fellow Democrat John Ossoff won in Senate runoffs in January 2021, just months after President Biden became the first Democratic presidential candidate to win Georgia in 28 years. Now Warnock has shown those wins were no flukes, setting up Georgia as a key toss-up target for 2024. Walker's candidacy was a fundamental assault by the Republican Party on the dignity of Black Americans, said Caroline Randall Williams in The Atlantic. The GOP cynically propped up a morally and intellectually bankrupt charlatan, parading him around like blue ribbon livestock to pretend they care about black voters, even as their policies show contempt for people of color. The obliging Walker put on an act of grotesque minstrelsy, willing to sing and dance on a world stage against his best interest. Whatever reputation he once had lies in ruins, and the party that used him does not care. The biggest loser here is Trump, said Robert Reich in The Guardian. Walker's entire candidacy was a Trump creation, and like the Trump shuttle, Trump stakes, Trump University, and the Trump Foundation, it sank under a miasma of ineptitude, lies, and embarrassing allegations. Georgia voters also rejected Trump's handpicked primary challengers to Governor Brian Kemp and Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger, whom he targeted for refusing to help him overturn Georgia's vote in 2020. In many respects, Georgia is becoming Trump's Waterloo. Walker's flameout is more proof that the Republican Party desperately needs to move on from Donald Trump, said Ross Douthat in the New York Times. This defeat is a fractal of the larger 2022 pattern in which the GOP ran many Trump-ordained candidates, saw them lose in defense of midterm precedents, and blew its shot at a Senate majority. The question now is whether this will be a deal-breaker for Republicans. At a certain point, even a potent demagogue needs to post some actual wins to hold his coalition together. Otherwise, he just starts to look like, well, a loser. And the controversy of the week, homelessness. Is it time for tough love? There aren't many more delicate political, social, and moral questions than those posed by the mental health crisis on America's streets, said Mike Kelly in the Bergen County, New Jersey Record. But New York City Mayor Eric Adams has begun searching for the answers. Adam last week issued a directive empowering police and first responders to detain homeless people suffering severe mental illness and transport them to hospitals for involuntary evaluation and treatment. This comes weeks after California Governor Gavin Newsom signed a statewide law allowing officials to commit mentally ill homeless people for up to 2 years. Homelessness has plagued the U.S. for half a century, since the shutdown of state mental hospitals where the severely mentally ill were warehoused in horrific conditions. Adams, a centrist Democrat, says society has a moral obligation to protect the homeless from themselves. He is also responding to the objections of New Yorkers to the thousands of homeless people on the streets, urinating and defecating, ranting and sometimes engaging in violence. Those objections are shared by citizens of Portland, San Francisco, Seattle, and other cities. Civil libertarians have long insisted that people have the right to make a lifestyle choice to live on the streets, said Zachary Faria in the Washington Examiner. But earlier this year, a homeless schizophrenic killed a New York City woman by pushing her in front of an oncoming subway train, and there were two similar subway attacks in October. Even liberal New Yorkers have a limit on how many people they'll allow to be pushed onto the subway tracks. Adams' plan is ambitious, said Eugene Robinson in the Washington Post, but not ambitious enough to make a real impact. Without an adequate supply of psychiatric hospital beds, those detained under Adams' directive will get at most a few weeks of medicalized incarceration, then be released back onto the streets. It's not clear this policy is even constitutional, said C.J. Ciaramella in Reason. By canceling the requirement that people must pose a danger to themselves or others before being committed, Adams is directly flouting a 1975 Supreme Court ruling that mental illness alone cannot be grounds for depriving people of their freedom. The fundamental problem is a lack of housing, said Stephen Short in the New York Daily News. Decades of studies have shown that medical treatment is of little use if troubled people do not have permanent housing in which to regain a sense of autonomy and agency and start rebuilding their shattered lives. Instead of trying to create the illusion of public safety by disappearing people, Adams and Newsom should focus on increasing our supply of supportive housing with mental health services. Sadly, that's not going to happen, said Zachary Wolf in CNN. Creating housing for the mentally ill homeless is expensive and politically difficult. Spare us the liberal piety, said Noah Rothman in commentary. For most people who are dangerously mentally ill, the lack of housing is more a problem of demand than supply. They choose to live on the streets because of their paranoid delusions, inability to hold jobs, and addictions. Cities have tried opening shelters, cycling people in and out of substance treatment and hospitalization, and ignoring the problem. None of it has worked. So city streets are filled with legions of lost souls sleeping in tents, under blankets, and in cardboard boxes, amid the growing feeling of squalor and menace. It's time for something different. And our good week, bad week piece. It was a good week for small game hunters after New York City began a search for a highly motivated and somewhat bloodthirsty individual to be the new rat czar. The job listing says the successful applicant will have a general aura of badassery. It was a good week for Japanese school children, who, as of this week, may resume talking during lunchtime, which was banned by the government at the start of the pandemic. Loud talking is still verboten, however. And it was a good week for specificity after a lawyer for Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, who has called Florida a state where woke goes to die, was required to define woke in a court hearing. The lawyer said the much-reviled term means the belief there are systemic injustices in American society and the need to address them. It was a bad week for yucks after Supreme Court Justice Samuel Alito joked during oral arguments about seeing black children in Ku Klux Klan outfits and suggested Justice Elena Kagan might be familiar with AshleyMadison.com, a dating service for people seeking affairs. It was a bad week for sleep hygiene after the arrest in Mannheim, Germany, of a 72-year-old hospital patient who allegedly turned off her roommate's oxygen machine not once but twice because she was disturbed by the noise it made. Finally, it was a bad week for finding emptiness after a Buddhist temple in Thailand was left unstaffed after all four of its resident monks tested positive for methamphetamine. I never thought that drugs would spread to the temples, said a community leader. Our briefing this week is titled, Teens in Crisis. American adolescents are suffering an epidemic of anxiety and depression. Why? What's happening to kids? Every available marker shows that over the past decade, rates of anxiety, depression, and suicide have surged among children and teens in the U.S. The pandemic clearly made the problem worse, but the problem predates COVID, and it is consistent across regional and demographic lines. From 2009 to 2017, depression spiked 69% among 16 to 17-year-olds, according to the National Survey on Drug Use and Health. From 2009 to 2021, according to a Centers for Disease Control study, the share of high school students feeling persistent feelings of sadness or hopelessness rose from 26 to 44%, the highest level ever recorded. Younger people are afflicted as well. Suicide is now the second leading cause of death for children 10 to 14, according to the CDC. The American Academy of Pediatrics says there are dramatic increases in hospital visits for mental health emergencies for the young, and declared the surge a national emergency. What's driving the crisis? There appears to be a confluence of factors, but many social and child psychologists believe smartphones and social media play a central role. The circumstantial evidence there is undeniable. The crisis emerged in the exact years when American teens were getting smartphones and becoming daily users of social media, social psychologist Jonathan Haidt told a Senate subcommittee in May. Over the past decade, he said, online life transformed childhood activity, attention, social relationships, and consciousness. Social media can be damaging because it continually presents young people with images of others who seem more confident, successful, and attractive, making them feel inadequate and left out. They're bombarded with messages that erode their sense of self-worth, U.S. Surgeon General Vivek Murthy wrote in a 2021 report. Facebook's internal research showed that a third of teen girls said Instagram made them feel worse. Teens who spend 5 hours or more a day online are twice as likely to report unhappiness as those who spend less than an hour, according to Jean Twenge, a psychologist and author of iGen. Another problem is that the internet presents teens struggling to form a sense of self with a staggering number of different possible identities. Finally, when kids spend so much time online, they also lose face-to-face connections with friends, mentors, and other adults. Why does that matter? Interacting mostly by text or social media lacks a warm human dimension that leaves many teens feeling lonely. Teens are primed for social connection, said Joseph Allen, a clinical psychologist who specializes in adolescent social development. Social media, he said, doesn't give them what they need. Kids who spend long hours online spend less time outside playing sports, exercising, and attending religious services or other community activities, all of which help boost their mood. And with their phones and video games beckoning them 24/7, with features engineered to be addictive, teens are sleeping less. There's a mountain of evidence linking poor sleep to mental health issues, and today's adolescents are sleeping less than ever. The average high schooler now gets 6.5 hours instead of the 9 optimal for their age, leaving a generation with severe chronic sleep deprivation. Research shows that a lack of sleep triggers the reactive and negative emotional centers of the brain. Some experts, however, are wary of pinning all the blame on phones and social media, and point to factors beyond the internet, including modern parenting styles. How has parenting changed? Psychologists warn that helicopter parenting, with moms and dads hovering over every aspect of their kids' lives, impedes kids' ability to gain autonomy and develop confidence. In accommodative parenting, moms and dads try to eliminate sources of stress for their kids, who as a result don't learn how to deal with adversity and develop persistence. Research has also found that the pervasiveness of ominous news about climate change, partisan rancor, and the economy from various media sources leaves kids deeply pessimistic about the future. In a youth survey published last year in The Lancet, nearly half of the respondents said worries about the fate of the planet interfered with their sleep and ability to enjoy themselves. What can be done? There is widespread agreement that pediatricians, parents, teachers, and schools need to put greater emphasis on detecting kids' emotional and mental health issues and providing help when they get in trouble. Last year, 38 states enacted laws designed to improve school mental health resources, prevent suicides, and promote mental wellness among young people, according to the National Academy for State Health Policy. In October, the Biden administration announced more than $300 million in funding for youth mental health services, some of it aimed at addressing a dearth of trained mental health professionals. Advocates call for expanded research into why so many teens are struggling. "We need to figure it out," said Candace Odgers, a psychologist at the University of California, Irvine, "because it's life or death for these kids." Into the best columns of the week. We'll start with Trump has disqualified himself. If there was any remaining doubt about Donald Trump's intentions, said Charles Cook, he is now informing us that he aspires to be a tyrant. Last week, an enraged Trump declared on his social media site that because Hunter Biden's laptop didn't receive more coverage before the 2020 election, the 45th president should be declared the rightful winner and reinstalled in the White House. "Election fraud of this magnitude," Trump said, "allows for the termination of all rules, regulations, and articles, even those found in the Constitution." Some Republicans are dismissing his latest lunacy by saying Trump, who has already declared his 2024 candidacy, wouldn't have the ability to terminate the Constitution even if he were reelected. But his unhinged threat suggests mental illness and should be his political suicide note. Trump's monstrous behavior in office shows he truly believes the Constitution can be ignored. After he lost a free and fair election in 2020 by 7 million votes, Trump attempted to stage a coup. He pressured Mike Pence to unilaterally declare Trump president, and when he refused, Trump incited a riot. The time for evasion is over. Trump is not a patriot. He's a loser and a cheat, and in his heart of hearts, a tyrant. Democrats betray rail workers. Democrats had a golden opportunity last week to prove they really care about working class men and women, said Will Bunch. Instead, President Biden and his congressional allies have imposed a labor contract on 115,000 rail workers that denies them any paid sick leave. Biden once promised to be the most pro-union president in history, but didn't use his leverage in negotiations to demand that rail freight companies provide the 7 paid sick days a year the workers wanted. These rail companies, which have annual revenues of $27 billion, opposed any paid sick time because they've adopted precision-scheduled railroading, computerized worker assignments that have enabled them to cut payrolls by 30%. These assignments assume workers can't call in sick. So if rail workers get COVID or the flu or need to see a doctor, they must use paid vacation time and schedule it in advance. That's barbaric. Why do neither of our two major political parties care about the working class? Republicans woo blue-collar workers with exploitative culture wars, while Democrats have become solely the party of college degree holders. Washington protects corporate profits, not powerless workers who simply want a healthy middle-class life. Inviting diseases to return. In a modern society, there can be no excuse for an outbreak of measles, said Michael Hiltzik. And yet, despite a vaccine that's over 93% effective, the U.S. is facing a measles surge. Columbus, Ohio now has a measles outbreak of at least 44 cases, every one of them among unvaccinated kids. A larger outbreak of this highly infectious, sometimes fatal disease may be coming, both in Columbus and across the nation, because of the rising influence of the anti-vaccination movement. The number of anti-vaxxers exploded during the COVID pandemic when President Trump and his right-wing echo chamber made defiance of public health measures a badge of partisan identity. As a direct result of this anti-science sentiment, the reddest counties had COVID death rates more than triple those of the bluest. Now, anti-vaxxers are spreading destructive disinformation about childhood vaccines for such diseases as measles, rubella, mumps, chickenpox, and polio, and many red states are losing vaccination mandates. In Texas, a third of kids have not been fully vaccinated. That should scare you. If millions of Americans shun vaccines, defeated diseases will make a comeback. And it's time for the last word, our feature article. The dreadful sound of silence. The quietest place on earth is reputed to drive visitors crazy, said Katie Weaver in the New York Times Magazine. Spending 3 hours inside seemed like an irresistible challenge. In a leafy Minneapolis neighborhood under a thick cloak of ivy stands a modest concrete building. Contained within the building is silence exceeding the bounds of human perception. This hush is preserved in a small room, expensively engineered to be echoless. The room of containment, technically an anechoic chamber, is the quietest place on the planet, according to some. What happens to people inside the windowless steel room is the subject of wild speculation. Public fascination with the room exploded 10 years ago after an article on the Daily Mail's website claimed that no one had ever survived a visit of longer than 45 minutes. You'll hear your heart beating, the room's soft-spoken proprietor, Stephen J. Orfield of Orfield Laboratories, was quoted as saying. And in the anechoic chamber, you become the sound. Earlier this year, members of the public began apparently spontaneously and via TikTok and YouTube convincing one another that the room was created as an invitation to compete, that spending a few hours alone inside it entitled a person to a cash prize, that the value of this cash prize was up to $7 million, and that anyone could attempt to win it. There was no contest, but the mystique of the too quiet room, if construed by outsiders, has perhaps been bolstered by the company's website, which advertises an experience called the Orfield Challenge, whereby for $600 an hour, a person can attempt to set a new record for time spent in the chamber. A person inside the anechoic chamber will not hear nothing. The human body is in constant motion, inhaling and expelling air, settling limbs into new positions, pumping blood and so on, constantly creating sounds. An anechoic chamber does not sharpen hearing. It removes the noise that otherwise drowns out the soft, ceaseless sounds of a body, enabling them to be perceived with novel clarity. The body is only totally still, totally silent in death. Much of the lore about the chamber's propensity for mind annihilation centers on the concept of blood sounds. It is oft reported experience in anechoic chambers For visitors to become aware of the sound of blood pumping in their heads or sloshing through veins, owing either to blood sound-induced insanity or cost, the record duration in the Orfield chamber was, until very recently, just 2 hours. I wanted to set a new world record for something. Even more than that, I wanted to hear the forbidden blood song. I emailed Orfield Labs to book a 3-hour attempt, and a few days later boarded a plane to Minnesota. Orfield Laboratories is laid out like a rabbit warren, a largely windowless hodgepodge of isolated rooms and passageways of unpredictable sizes and shapes, arranged along a meandering path of blind curves. The building was constructed in 1970 as a recording studio with spaces for multiple musicians to work concurrently without polluting one another's sessions. In its musical heyday, when the building was known as Sound 80, these included Bob Dylan and Prince. Stephen J. Orfield describes his facility as a multi-sensory design research operation. He purchased the anechoic room in the 1980s from Sunbeam when the appliance manufacturer was closing its Chicago facilities. Figuring it a good investment, he paid members of the University of Chicago football team to disassemble the chamber and load it onto 3 semi-trucks. In 1994, Orfield reassembled the chamber in Minneapolis, just steps from the room where the disco hit Funky Town was recorded, and put it to use for his product design clients. Orfield's chamber is a 6-sided box with walls of 4-inch insulated steel, suspended by springs inside a larger 5-sided box, itself contained within the larger laboratory. The chamber is behind a hinged steel block. Rigid brown fiberglass wedges press in upon it from all sides. The wedges poking up from the ground are visible beneath a walkable mesh floor. The whole room smells like old dry paper and is lightly bouncy. The lab's gray ponytailed manager, Michael Roll, outlined the terms I would need to adhere to in order to set a new record. I would need to stay in the room for 3 hours. It was my choice to have the lights on or off. I opted for total darkness. Sometimes people like to lay down or sit on the floor, so I leave a nice padded blanket in there, Roll said, handing me a blue blanket, which I spread across the floor before shutting the door, leaving me in lightless silence. To start, I lay on my stomach, a position I felt was relaxed enough for my body to acclimatize to the lack of stimulation, but uncomfortable enough to prevent my immediately falling asleep. I then resolved to lie on my back, and once supine, I experienced the unique and briefly frightening sensation that my ears were traveling up very fast in an elevator while the rest of my body fell gently toward earth. I had the distinct feeling of my ear canals filling with an inrushing silence that was somehow thicker than the quiet I had first noticed in the chamber. Within seconds, this ceased, and everything sounded, or rather continued to have no sound, exactly the same as before. I groped around for the notepad and pen I'd brought and recorded the observations that started to roll in. Gray ponytail, thick silence. But was I recording them? It was impossible to tell in the unrelenting dark. What if the free hotel pen didn't work? And why do I, a professional journalist, constantly find myself relying on free hotel pens during crucial moments of my assignments? I had prepared rather thoroughly for this assignment, having contacted Dr. Barbara Shin Cunningham, the director of Neuroscience Institute at Carnegie Mellon University, and asked her if becoming aware of my own body sounds would make me go insane. No, she said, unless you have a predilection for being insane to begin with, which, you know, could be. That opened up a new avenue of inquiry. I called Dr. Oliver Mason, a researcher of psychotic disorders at the University of Surrey, who has led studies monitoring subjects' experiences in anechoic chambers. If you take away all sensory input, Mason said, our brains, which are always trying to distinguish signal from noise anyway, simply see signal where there objectively isn't one. Mason offered to send me a questionnaire to gauge my psychosis proneness. Some of its questions prompted obvious answers. Does it often happen that nearly every thought immediately and automatically suggests an enormous number of ideas? God, no, I wish. On occasions, you have seen a person's face in front of you when no one was in fact there. No, what? Others caused me to wonder whether I had always assumed to be typical and commonplace life experiences shared across humankind were in fact normal. When in the dark, do you often see shapes and forms even though there's nothing there? Yes, what? Are your thoughts sometimes so strong that you can almost hear them? Isn't that just how thought works? I switched to a pencil. Preliminary notes thus recorded, but what if maybe not? I lay back and imbibed the silence. I had yet to hear the fearsome sound of rushing blood, but my mind had entered a riveting pre-sleep phase, racing through random thoughts and concepts, my attention galloping to keep up. My contemplations reeled to persons who had wronged me, in ways in which I might have revenge, all perfectly legal, of course. At the same time, my brain was delighting me with images of memes I had recently enjoyed, and memories of waiting to be picked up from my elementary school. I thought about things I might say to various celebrities if I ever met them. The Delta Airlines customer service hold music, which I had recently listened to for over an hour, mumbled into my head. Whoops, I was definitely about to fall asleep and still had not managed to sneak a peep at the awesome and terrible abyss of consciousness revealed when overhearing the odyssey of one's own blood. I whipped my head back and forth to try to make my blood slosh. I detected no liquid movement, but my swishing hair was very loud. Too loud. I fastened it with a clip to quiet it. Inspired by my hair, I determined to gather data about other normally quiet things I might do that would now be loud. You know what was loud? Massaging my scalp. Raising my eyebrows was, too. Chomping my teeth produced a resonant sound inside my head. The rustling of my papers as I jotted down notes was extremely loud, too. But always, whenever my movements ceased, the silence of the chamber rushed back in, like the tide obliterating a footprint in the sand. With no reference points, time passed strangely in the chamber, or rather, I was plagued by worries that time might possibly be passing strangely. The panicked idea, what if I've only been in here for 15 minutes, flapped around my consciousness like a trapped moth for hours. And so it is difficult to say at what point this next thing happened. Let's call it the 2-hour mark. I was lying prostrate on the blanket and trying for, let's call it, the 40,000th time to hear my blood. I flopped onto my back, and as I did, a bolt of nervous exhilaration shot through me. I had just noticed my first visual hallucination, a sliver of bright light in the darkness. I stared at the sliver for several seconds, waiting for it to mutate into a psychedelic light show, or Satan's face. In 1951, Donald Hebb, a professor at McGill University, received a grant from Canada's Defense Research Board, with the enthusiastic encouragement of the CIA, to study the effects of sensory deprivation. In one experiment, Hebb's subjects, college students, were led to a small room and instructed to don gloves and cardboard arm sleeves to limit their touch perception, and translucent plastic visors to limit their vision. A U-shaped foam rubber pillow and the continuous hum of an air conditioner muffled their hearing. They would be paid $20 a day, they were told, to lie in bed and do nothing. Few of the students walked away with more than $40 or $60. Many of them said that after prolonged stints in isolation, they began seeing images. The hallucinations tended to manifest first as simple forms like lines or dots of light. Over time, these evolved into complex patterns and then detailed scenes. One student reported having observed what a researcher recorded as a procession of squirrels with sacks over their shoulders marching purposefully across the visual field. While initially amused and interested by these images, researchers noted the subjects eventually found them disturbing and inescapable. In Orfield's chamber, the bright line did not mutate under my gaze, except when I took off my glasses, which made it blurry. Was I hallucinating a common effect of removing spectacles? I put my glasses back on, took them back off. There was absolutely a 100% correlation between no glasses and the line going fuzzy at the edges. Could this be a sophisticated delusion of playing off my brain's expectation of alterations to my field of vision when I removed my glasses? I wondered. No, I had discovered a hairline crack in the wall of insulation, I realized. I had spent several minutes staring in anxious fascination at a beam of office light. How many things do we misinterpret as out of the ordinary because we are told online that they are? The sole hallucination I had experienced on my journey to the rumored brink of insanity was one manufactured in the brains of other people, a collective fantasy that a room could be made hazardously quiet. In theory, the internet would seem a likely tool for efficiently obliterating such incorrect notions. In practice, it functions as a loudspeaker placed at the mouth of a cave. It disseminates noise indiscriminately, and this noise grows increasingly distorted and cacophonous as it bounces off the walls in all directions. We, the audience, know this, yet we insist on finding news in the noise. Without warning, the overhead light flashed on, and Michael Roll pushed open the door to greet me. I felt embarrassed to be caught sitting alone in the dark, as if Roll had not left me in that position 3 hours earlier. Despite the pleasant sensation I noted as I quit the chamber, my time there had been as sedative as a spa visit, only much more expensive and uncomfortable. I left Minneapolis in a melancholy mood. I had not won up to $7 million. I hadn't even lost my mind. This was adapted from an article that originally appeared in the New York Times Magazine. We're going to read two obituaries this week, starting with the songbird who soared in Fleetwood Mac, Christine McVie, 1943 to 2022. Christine McVie had a soulful, soothing presence. As a longtime member of Fleetwood Mac, the British singer, songwriter, and keyboardist was a steady voice of affirmation in a band that created its most enduring work amid emotional turmoil. While the mystical singer Stevie Nicks and the coiled singer-guitarist Lindsey Buckingham loomed larger as personalities, it was McVie who proved the group's biggest hit maker. She wrote or co-wrote half the songs on the band's 1988 Greatest Hits anthology, including the breezy radio staples, Say You Love Me, Over My Head, You Make Loving Fun, and Don't Stop. The latter two helped propel the band's high watermark, 1977's Mega Platinum Rumors, which was famously fueled by the romantic wreckage of Nick's split with Buckingham and McVie's divorce from bassist John McVie. You Make Loving Fun was written for an extramarital lover, while Don't Stop was a message for the husband McVie was leaving. I write about romantic despair a lot, she said in 2017, but with a positive spin. She was born Christine Perfect in Northwest England, said Rolling Stone. Her father was a concert violinist and a music professor. Her mother, a psychic and faith healer. She studied classical piano until she hit her teens, when her interest turned to blues and rock and roll. After art school, she moved to London, where she played in a variety of bands, including a popular blues outfit called Chicken Shack. She married John McVie in 1968 and joined Fleetwood Mac 2 years later. In a bid to revive the founding band's fortunes, the members moved to Los Angeles in 1974, where Buckingham and Nicks joined. The new lineup proved almost instantly magical, said the Associated Press. The band's next album, 1975's Fleetwood Mac, was a smash, selling 8 million copies. 2 years later, even that success was dwarfed by rumors. Worn down by touring, McVie retired from the band in 1998 and spent the next 16 years living quietly in the English countryside, said the Telegraph. Eventually, she grew restless and rejoined in 2014, embarking on several tours over the next 5 years. In failing health, she released a final solo record last spring, and in an interview with Rolling Stone, looked back fondly on the band's peak years. Even though I am quite a peaceful person, she said, I did enjoy that storm. The Sesame Street icon who sang of Neighbors, Bob McGrath, 1932 to 2022. Generations of young children were on a first-name basis with Bob McGrath. A founding cast member on Sesame Street, McGrath spent 5 decades as affable, sweater-clad music teacher Bob, who sang People in Your Neighborhood and acted as a cheerful foil to Oscar the Grouch. It seemed to be the role McGrath was born to play. But in 1969, when a former University of Michigan fraternity brother alerted him to the casting opportunity, he was skeptical. I thought, here's another silly kiddie show, recalled McGrath, a tenor who had become an unlikely teen pop idol in Japan. Seeing tapes of Jim Henson's work changed his mind. I thought, to heck with that teenage thing, he said. This is what I want to do. McGrath started his life on a small farm with no electricity outside Ottawa, Illinois, said the Newark, New Jersey Star-Ledger. A singer since age 5, he majored in music and toured Europe with the 7th Army Symphony during the Korean War. In 1961, he was cast on Sing Along with Mitch, a squeaky clean TV show that invited viewers to sing along to folk songs and pop standards. McGrath performed regularly in Japan in the mid-1960s, said Variety. Japanese teenagers who had been learning English by following the show's on-screen lyrics flocked to his concerts. But Sesame Street, a pop cultural force from its debut on PBS, would more enduringly define his public image. McGrath appeared in more than 460 episodes, including several of the show's most iconic sequences, such as the 1983 show where Big Bird learns about the death of grocer Mr. Hooper. Viewers were outraged when HBO took over the broadcasting rights in 2016 and fired 3 longtime cast members, including McGrath, said the New York Times. He took the news graciously, saying he was glad to have spent 47 years working with phenomenal people, and was ready for more time with his family. Some Sesame Street viewers already felt that close to him. In a 2004 interview, he recalled meeting a boy who immediately took his hand. "Do you know my name?" McGrath said. "Bob," the child said. "Do you know any of my other friends on Sesame Street?" McGrath continued. Without hesitating, the boy said, "Oh, the number 7. And as usual, we'll wrap up on the Talking Points page. Here's an article titled, "Primaries, Why Democrats Are Dumping Iowa." If President Biden and the Democratic National Committee have their way, a political calendar half a century old will be a thing of the past, said Jeff Greenfield in Politico. Iowa and New Hampshire will lose their coveted status as the first two contests in the Democratic presidential nominating cycle, after DNC officials last week backed Biden's proposal to start with South Carolina, the state whose sizable black population rescued his candidacy in 2020. Biden's plan calls for Nevada and New Hampshire to come next, on the same day, diluting the Granite State's influence, and then on to big swing states Georgia and Michigan. The rationale for this big reshuffle is simple. Despite the long tradition of candidates campaigning at Iowa state fairs and New Hampshire diners, a party this diverse cannot give such massive overattention to two nearly all-white states. Iowa also has a convoluted caucus process, said Laura Belin in CNN.com, and in 2020 there were massive problems computing which Democrat won. Why continue to put up with that nonsense? The demotion of Iowa highlights Democrats' growing disregard for the heartland, said Dave Seminara in the Wall Street Journal. Like many states with a large base of white working-class voters, Iowa has swung to the right since 2016. In a woke era, no politician will admit to courting white voters, but they remain 73% of the national electorate. Democrats write them off at their own peril. Biden's reason for favoring South Carolina are obvious, said W. James Antle III in the Washington Examiner. In 2020, he finished a humiliating 4th in the Iowa caucus and 5th in New Hampshire, then won big in South Carolina and never looked back. By changing the primary order, Biden is signaling he plans to run again in 2024. Starting off with diverse states has another benefit for Biden, said Walter Shapiro in the New Republic. It's the anti-Bernie plan. Black voters in the South are mostly moderate and pragmatic, preferring candidates who can win the general election. They generally don't swoon for left-wing maverick candidates like Senator Bernie Sanders and the late Senator Eugene McCarthy, who have thrilled white progressives in New Hampshire and Iowa. The new primary calendar stamps the Democrats as a center-left party for years to come, and proves, once again, the president's political instincts have been underestimated. And some shorter notes. About 22% of active American voters claim no religious affiliation, the same percentage of the electorate that identifies as Catholic. In the midterm elections, the nuns preferred Democratic House candidates over Republican ones by 65% to 31%. More than 900,000 people born in other countries have become American citizens so far this year, according to the Pew Research Center. Naturalizations plummeted during the pandemic, but have since increased by 20% above pre-pandemic averages. At least 1.2 million U.S. households were headed by a same-sex couple in 2021, according to the Census Bureau's American Community Survey, more than double the number in 2008. Nearly 60% of those couples were married. Slurs against black, Jewish, gay, and transgender people spiked after Elon Musk invited virtually all banned accounts back to Twitter, according to the research by the Center for Countering Digital Hate. Before Musk's takeover, there were an average of 1,282 tweets slurring black people every day. Afterward, the number jumped to 3,876. Anti-Semitic tweets and slurs against transgender people each increased by more than 60%. On the poll watch, 64% of Americans say social media has been bad for democracy, compared with 34% who say it's been good. 79% of Americans say the internet has made people more divided politically, and 69% said it's made people less civil. And we'll finish with a quote from Billy Connolly, quoted in The Scotsman, who says, "Before you judge a man, walk a mile in his shoes. After that, who cares? He's a mile away, and you've got his shoes." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next week. We hope you have enjoyed it. This is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information or if you have comments or questions, please give us a call, 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.